Good morning, and welcome to Talking About California. Here we continue our series of discussions with Californians who talk about this place, this state, California, and their work here. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host. I'm the director of the Mendocino Institute. This morning, we'll be talking with Professor Jonathan Simon, the Adrian A. Cragen Professor of Law at Bolt Hall, University of California. Good morning, Jonathan. Is that all right?
That's great. Good morning, Cal.
Let me say a word about Jonathan. Before joining the Bolt Hall faculty in 2003, he was a professor at the University of Miami School of Law, and previously to that, an assistant professor at the University of Michigan. In the spring of 2011, he was appointed to the Lieberholm Visiting Professorship of Law at the University of Edinburgh. That's a great place. My daughter spent some time there. Did you enjoy it?
Oh, I loved it. Only the Bay Area could feel like a good deal coming home after a year in Edinburgh.
I'll bet. Jonathan teaches courses on criminal law, criminal justice, law and culture, risk and the law, and socio-legal studies. His scholarship concerns the role of criminal justice and punishment in modern societies, the cultural lives of law, and the intellectual history of law and the social sciences. His books include, and there are many, Poor Discipline, Parole, and the Social Control of the Underclass, and Governing Through Crime, How the War on Crime Transformed American Democracy and Created a Culture of Fear. His most recent undertakings, Mass Incarceration on Trial and The Sage Handbook of Punishment in Society, are forthcoming to be published this year, it looks like.
Actually, the Sage book is now out, I'm pleased to say, and it looks like the new press monograph will hopefully be out next fall.
Okay, so the Sage Handbook of Punishment in Society is out. So anyway, it's a very long CV here, and I'd better stop, and I hope you don't mind, or we won't have any time to talk.
Of course.
It's not often we get to talk with someone like Jonathan on the program. I hope listeners will be looking forward to this. Obviously, so many topics we've already heard about and so many questions. But maybe first, could you just tell us a bit about your own story, how you became, are you a lawyer?
Well, I have a JD. I am not admitted to practice. I can honestly say I've never flunked the bar. I've just never taken it. I did get my law degree here at Berkeley Law in the 80s while I was simultaneously getting a doctoral degree in our jurisprudence and social policy program. And I've been fascinated by law throughout that time. But I've always realized that probably my comparative advantage wasn't actually practicing it. I've known some excellent lawyers, including my wife, and at least I know enough to know that I'm probably not that person.
Okay. And to go from there, Jonathan, you're teaching the law in what seems to me to be a kind of volatile time, or maybe it's always volatile in your area. I've just see Pelican Bay's in the news again. Just thinking about California, really.
Yeah.
The Dormer case. We've always got marijuana on trial up here. The death penalty, same-sex marriages. Maybe we could begin with some generalizations. Why this level of conflict? Why so much unsettlement, it seems? And is it unsettlement in the law, or is it really just always this way?
That's a great question. I mean, I hope we can visit these specific issues in turn, and I'll try not to filibuster and try to address all of them in my first at-bat here. But for me, I see this very personally, perhaps having come here to go to college at Berkeley, I think exactly 35 years ago this last fall, having grown up in the Midwest and heard enough about California to know that I wanted to get out there by any means necessary. I showed up in the fall of 1977 as an undergraduate here at Cal, and I was blown away by California as a technological powerhouse. I mean, BART was stunning to me, having grown up with the Chicago Loop trains, and of course the incredible education system, which I saw not only obviously firsthand at Berkeley, but also then I met, you know, students from all over the state. And one of the things that was so moving and stunning to me at the time was that they really were from all over and from all walks of life, I should say, that isn't statuses. And you get the sense that California K through 12 schools were really capable of lifting people from every background in terms of class disadvantage, et cetera, to a position where they could compete for a place like Berkeley. And that was extraordinary. I feel, and we can talk about this, that in many ways we are at the things you point to now, the sense of crisis and transformation that surrounds a lot of our penal practices and policies in our criminal justice system generally, is sort of the end of an arc that began, you know, paradoxically, just around the time that I was moving to what I took to be this remarkable state, which had made this, you know, remarkable commitment to progressive infrastructure rich environment. Ironically, probably the first year I could vote, you know, because I registered to vote and I became a citizen of California in 1978, was the year that an expanded death penalty was on the ballot, the one that we still have, and as a very problematic law that we can talk about. And a whole host of other things were in the works that would transform California into a kind of penal super state in many regards, and a very poor educational state. So I really feel that we're, you know, Cal, to look at the big picture, that we really are kind of at the end of an arc that runs about 40 years. And you're more of a card-carrying historian than I am, but as a kind of criminologist, sociologist who dabbles in history, I think there maybe something to the biblical notion that 40 years is about what it takes for something important to run through a culture, whether it's slavery in the desert or mass incarceration and the kind of penal panic that we were in. The 70s was a very pivotal moment, and for those of us who can actually remember those years, I think it's very important to kind of remind ourselves how many things are different about our state then and now.
Well, I wasn't expecting that answer, so help me out here. Let's go there. What was different in the 70s?
Well, for one thing, we had a very, very small prison system that was extremely progressive in its ambitions, and that was mostly focused on keeping people out of prison and either on probation, never going to prison to begin with, or through parole, getting them out of prison very quickly. We were very unpunitive. It's remarkable in retrospect, but somebody who was convicted of first-degree murder in the 1970s could very realistically be expect to be out of prison in less than a decade. Today, somebody who commits the most sympathetic kind of murder, if there is such a thing, what we in the law would call, say, a second-degree murder, usually something that's maybe done under a spur of the moment under a certain level of environmental provocation, can realistically expect to do 20 or 25 or 35 years or more for that crime. And, of course, we've gone from having about 20,000 prisoners to having around 160,000 at the moment, down a bit from our peak. So in terms of punishment, we went through a sea change of both philosophy and practice. We also went from a state that was basically very, very focused on developing its human capital through education mostly, but also through heavy investments in kind of technological infrastructures, to a state that has disinvested in a huge way from essentially the educational side of human capital. And if you view our mass incarceration policies from a human capital point of view, we've essentially invested in degrading a great number of our citizens' human capital. And if you look at the number of people who have been through our system over the last 40 years, just phenomenal. So that's a nutshell of sort of the sea change in the kind of government we had and have in the state. Ironically, then, all of those things are kind of up for revisiting now. The death penalty, our commitment to sort of incarcerating everybody we possibly can for as long as we possibly can. And I guess I would also suggest that in my new book, I try to explore this. The experience of the 70s, although many of us would choose to remember the exciting and sort of exhilarating parts of it, it's also a very scary decade. And in particular, in terms of crime, California had an endless series of serial killers in the state, roaming the state in those years. It was certainly fueled in part by the complete abandonment of any public mental health system and the shutting down of our hospitals. Not that we should view most of the people who were there, who were warehoused in those hospitals as having been a threat to the public. They weren't, but we kind of got out of the business of warehousing people we thought were mentally ill and into the business of ignoring everybody's mental problems, no matter how severe they got. So a lot of that was happening in those years, along with, as I said, a very serious crime problem that was as bad or worse than other parts of the country and went on longer. Most of the country, the violence began to level off by the mid-70s. It kept coming here right through the end of the decade. And again, while we haven't had quite as remarkable a crime decline as, say, New York has, and we can talk about some of the reasons why we haven't done as well, I think there's no doubt that, as bad as sometimes things seem in Oakland on a particular weekend, et cetera, overall in California, as in the rest of the country, crime is considerably lower than it was, and especially violent crime, in the 1970s. And therefore, I think the public is less traumatized, frankly, by kind of a persistent drumbeat of fear, although the media certainly knows how to get that going.
Well, let's go back to the law. Now, how's the law fit in here? Or sometimes we hear that the law is kind of fixed and forever. But you're in the classroom during all of this. What's the law doing?
So, the law goes through some pretty dramatic changes. But I think it's always, it's a good historical rule of thumb to always keep in mind that, and this is the law and society side of me, that, that laws generally only become really consequential when they either get carried into action by, a tide of social movement or of cultural change. And I think there were a number of important legal changes in California in those years. One I've already pointed to, which is the transformation of mental health law, which is we often don't discuss in the same framework as our criminal justice system, but it's important too, I think, because it meant that we did kind of eliminate a major system for dealing with troubled people in our community. And there's just no doubt that one of the major sources of mass incarceration has been essentially as an alternative asylum for a population that we have just systematically not served, and as we said we would in the 70s with public with community-based treatment. That's one important legal change, which I'd certainly love to come back to because it's something on the California agenda for today as well. Another one was our sentencing system. As part of the kind of commitment to a more rehabilitative approach to punishment in the 1950s and 60s, California adopted one of the more indeterminate sentencing systems. Not just murderers, but virtually all felons were sent to prison with a potential life max on their sentence, but with the expectation that they would be paroled, after possibly a very short time, maybe only a matter of months or years at the most. And in those days, we had a parole board that was called the Adult Authority that had pretty much unreviewable discretion to set people's parole date and to release them to the community. The idea of the system is that it would allow a more medical approach where people would get as much penal treatment, quote-unquote, as they needed. In reality, it was widely criticized for, on the one hand, perhaps being not much of a deterrent if people expected that they would get parole very quickly. On the other hand, potentially very unfair to minorities and other people who might not get a good cultural shake, as it were, from decision makers with discretion, parole boards, judges. And so in 1976, under Governor Jerry Brown in his first incarnation as governor, California, with very little fanfare, passed something called the Determinate Sentencing Law. And what it did was it set a fixed sentence for most crimes. It chose a very arbitrary mechanism, actually, essentially a system where there's three terms for almost every crime. And the judge was actually required to set the middle term unless either aggravating or mitigating factors were shown. Our system has been modified, actually, a little bit by some court decisions that I don't want to diverge too much on, but it still more or less works that way, so that a crime like robbery in the 1970s, the person convicted of robbery would have faced something like 2 years to life in prison. Since 1976, they have faced three terms, something like, you know, 5, 7, and 11 years. The problem, of course, is that once you establish a sentencing system that way, when it was initially established in the mid in 76, the goal wasn't to grow the system. In fact, it was assumed that it would be steady state population-wise. But notice what it did was create a new system where the legislature could essentially change prison sentences by passing new laws amending those fixed terms. And as you can imagine, and this fits into a bit of the story I tell in Governing Through Crime, as politicians in the 80s and 90s discovered the enormous popularity of being tough on various criminal offenses, this opened up a huge, you know, opportunity for legislators to make a mark by, you know, pushing through legislation to up this or that sentence. And of course, nobody ever pushes through laws to reduce some other sentence. And as a result, over 1,000 different measures were passed in a 5-year period of the 80s alone, expanding prison sentences. And we can assume it pretty much went up regularly through that period, leading to where we are today, where, you know, until realignment, we can talk about what that means, but, you know, on the eve of realignment, people who in the 70s never would have gotten anywhere near state prison for relatively minor felony offenses or first offenses were going to, you know, state prison pretty much right off the bat, partly because of the law, partly because of the attitudes of prosecutors and public, you know, anxiety about crime. So that's another very important way in which the law changed in a way that facilitated the growth of punishment in prisons in California. But again, I don't want to put too much weight on the law because I don't think those laws, you know, came from a kind of political dynamic which is not completely, you know, isn't completely dependent on the law. It's coming from politics and from the community. And a book I would plug to your audience here, if you want to learn more about how California's prison system became quite as large and really, frankly, harsh and quite degrading in its penal style as California became, Josh Page's book, The Toughest Beat, which is a book about the rise of California's prison officers union. That's another thing that began in the late 70s. And whose political rise to just tremendous power in California politics went along with, you know, a rapid extension of prison sentences. So again, without filibustering, those are some of the legal markers. Again, they take place against a political background where lots of Californians, for reasons we can talk about, are, you know, recognizing themselves as potential crime victims and being effectively mobilized, you know, politically and culturally by the sense that they are in danger.
So I'm taken aback by one point. You did. Maybe you could say a bit more about this. 1,000 legislative interventions? Is that, and is this by the people involved sitting down and checking this all out, or their assistants and clerks?
It was a study done by the Stanford Center for Criminal Justice about 6 years ago now, actually, when they just started. And they literally had some law students take a 5-year period and just go through the you know, the amended statutes. They counted about 200 prison sentence extension amendments or laws per year during that 5-year period, leading to about 1,000. Again, you know, think about our perfect storm of difficult features of our political and legislative system. Somewhere in that period, we adopted term limits, which means that our California legislators have, you know, a fixed amount of time to stay in either the Assembly or the Senate before they have to move on to another job. That puts a premium on people being able to make a name for themselves quickly by putting through legislation that will be, you know, widely supported and certainly not controversial. It does, you know, it creates a system where nobody's around to take responsibility for the huge systemic messes that then get created. I mean, think about our mass incarceration result, which is, you know, I do want to get to, where the Supreme Court, not the most radical group of people you can imagine, you know, in 2011 said that our prisons were basically unfit for a civilized society. And they weren't just using those words, you know, casually. They were looking at pictures that looked more like third world prison conditions, not what I think California has expected even tough punishment to look like in California, but really degrading, inhumane, and really insecure prisons that, as the courts found, were probably more of a danger to the community than they were a source of public safety. Again, nobody in the legislature set out to do that, but also nobody was given an incentive to really take responsibility for that. And one of the things that I am personally very motivated by right now and would very much like to reach my fellow Californians on is the sense that we need to hold our political leaders accountable for, you know, what they did in our name, because it I think historians are going to view California's mass incarceration as on par with Epiphany's internment and the sterilization of mental patients back in the 1920s and 30s as sort of some of California's great shames.
That's worth thinking about, Jonathan. This is KZYX. I'm Cal Winslow, your host today on Talking About California. We are talking with the law professor, Jonathan Simon, from Bolt Hall at the University of California, and talking about a number of things, including his one of his books, Governing Through Crime. Jonathan, I'm taken aback by this again, and I'm going to have to leave my notes, but on the issue of mental health, you know, we've recently had our sort of gun moment up here, where a youngster, people thought of him that way, from Fort Bragg, killed a couple of people and then went into the woods to be hunted down by the various sheriff's office from around the state. And it raised a number of issues, including, especially from his parents, Aaron Basler's parents, the issues of mental health. And I know mental health is a controversial issue now in this area, but I think we have a handful, four or five people left in our public health services in Mendocino County, and the project itself is about to be privatized. Maybe you could tell us a bit more about your feelings about what's going on here, and including, I wonder, there was some discussion of a thing called Laura's Law. Have you ever come across that?
I have indeed. So, you know, it's an area worthy of an entire show like this one, so maybe we can do it again. But just to give you a nutshell, again, we have both a historical background that needs to be taken into account and a present situation. On the historical background is briefly that California, just as we've been kind of a super penal state in the era of mass incarceration, we were kind of a super mental hospitalizer in the mid-20th century. Very much at the forefront of a national movement to warehouse, I think is a fair term. Lots of people, both what we would today think of as the intellectually disabled, what used to be called the mentally retarded, as well as people suffering from a variety of not so serious and very serious mental illnesses. Infamously, in the mid 20th century, it was very easy to, especially for husband fathers, to hospitalize members of their families, their wives. By having a psychiatrist find that they would benefit from being hospitalized. That, of course, became a subject of a huge cultural and political controversy in the 50s and 60s. Everyone remembers books like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which helped to culturally delegitimize that system. California, as we have a tendency to do, sort of changed in a big way, and we decided to go from being like the major warehouser of people to having perhaps the toughest law in the country in terms of making it hard to hospitalize people. That was called the Lanterman-Petrus Short Act. And again, it was a really well-intended law. It was a civil rights law that was intended to prevent people from really being warehoused against their rights and against any real community need for them to be held like that. Flash to the present. I mean, in the intervening years, we have closed our mental hospitals. There's a handful open still in the state, but everyone agrees that we have probably not nearly enough beds to meet the needs of even conservative estimates of the need. Is the law at fault? it's again one of those complicated stories. It is true that the legal standard has become an impediment when parents, for instance, have a child who becomes seriously mentally ill, and it becomes even more of a problem if they're adult children. They can't simply hospitalize them. They need to show that they meet the legal standard, and indeed, even voluntary hospitalization is sometimes not possible unless, because of the insurance industry, has actually accepted these legal definitions as part of their own standards. To get that person hospitalized, unless you can show basically that they're a danger to themselves or to other people in a relatively narrow time frame, and that has proved to be just, it didn't inevitably have to be, but because there's so much kind of economic incentive to not hospitalize people, it's not a profitable thing to do, it's costly, etc. What we've ended up with is a system where, realistically, it's very, very hard to hospitalize people, even when everyone agrees, the doctors, the parents, etc., that the person would benefit from and is in serious danger, really, not immediately, but in a medium term. Currently, this is all being cast into the light by our parallel concern about gun violence, and there's a couple of things to say about that. One is, we've got a long history of having panics about the dangers associated with people with mental illness, and we ought to, sort of be on guard against that, because we have such a cultural tendency to do that. We should be really wary of it. And I think it's important to underscore that all the research, a lot of research has been done on this over the last 20 years, shows that it's only a very small and very definable component of the population of people with mental illness who pose any kind of serious threat of violence. And those are people who have a past history of responding violently to what's usually hallucinatory, command hallucinations that are telling them to hurt themselves or hurt other people. That's a very tiny percentage of even the population of people with very serious mental illnesses. And so the idea that somehow we would dramatically drop our violence rates if we were to screen and, say, isolate people with mental illness is incorrect and, I think, a dangerous and misleading idea. On the other hand, having created this system where people are virtually sealed off from hospitalization, we ought to recognize that we've created the opposite incentive, that is to jail people with mental illness, either so they'll get treatment, we can force them to be treated, and some parents are actually advised by associations and by their doctors that, the best thing that can happen to your adult child would be to have them get arrested so they can be forcibly medicated. Of course, then they get stuck in the criminal justice system. That has created a system where roughly a third of the people in our jails and prisons, are suffering from a serious mental illness, and as bad as the, community is as a site for giving them treatment, I mean, jails have turned out to be even worse, and prisons especially, because they're so overcrowded, and they weren't designed with mental health treatment in mind, shockingly, because that's a very long history of prisons being also mental hospitals in a way. Our prisons were designed without any real attention to that. It was part of this mass incarceration mania. So we are at a moment where I think we ought to consider revising mental health law to make it easier to hospitalize and treat people who aren't necessarily can't be shown to be immediately likely to hurt themselves or somebody else, but clearly are on a path toward degeneration where they're going to become degraded. Either they're homeless and using self-medicating with substance abuse out in the community, or they're in danger of being assaulted by others, or there's a whole host of risks they face. So I would really favor revisiting that. Now, Laura's Law is a version of one kind of fix to these laws that were passed, 30 years ago to make it harder to hospitalize people. They would generally allow what's called sometimes assisted outpatient treatment. Essentially, it would be a way of kind of coercing people into accepting treatment, usually being monitored by a social worker in the community, so they took their meds and hopefully received services and housing. It's a positive step, but actually it's not really being implemented very many places. It's a half step, if you will. It's up to each county to decide whether to administer it, and obviously the funds for it have often been siphoned off for other things at a time of tremendous demand. So I think, and also, it's a law that doesn't have very many teeth. I mean, the only way it can actually coerce people into accepting outpatient treatment is by threatening to put them into the process to have them involuntarily hospitalized, which, as we've just seen, is a very uncertain and difficult process to effectuate in terms of hospitalizing anybody. So I would prefer to see a process where we revisited the Lantern and Petra Short Act in order to restore its original goal of civil rights by putting the emphasis today, and this is a much bigger topic, but I'll just give you a quick introduction to it. Instead of focusing so much on the liberty interests of people to not be hospitalized or confined, I would follow a path that was not obvious in the 70s, but is much more open now, and that is a human rights approach, a human rights law approach, which is closer to what they do in Europe. And there the emphasis is on the dignity of the person and making sure that they are treated in a way that protects their dignity. That sometimes could require us to treat them when it would be degrading for them to, say, be homeless and decompensating on the street. Other times it requires us to listen to their own demands for a different kind of treatment or for accommodation. But it would focus more on how we treat people and less on whether they're in or out of treatment or hospital. So that gives you a flavor of where we could go on that issue.
Well, thanks. Very interesting. A question I can't help but sort of bring up from this part of the world, and that's the question about marijuana. But I wanted to frame it somewhat larger than that. One of the things it seems to me is that a large number of people, perhaps in the country, but certainly up in these northern counties, don't really believe there's anything wrong with growing, consuming, selling marijuana, and find themselves in communities where it's pretty much accepted as a way of supporting oneself, as a way of entertaining oneself. So, what are your thoughts about that kind of a situation where you have a population that seems to be at odds with the law?
Well, I think, you know, the law is finally, it seems to me, moving, and while we, proposition several years ago to fully legalize, you know, so-called recreational use was defeated in California. As you know, similar versions were passed in both Washington and Colorado. They have their own problems. We could talk more about them. I think the law is on its way, and what we ought to celebrate here is this is a real opportunity to reverse what I talked about in the book Governing Through Crime. There I said, you know, one of the things that had happened to America is that we had developed this bad habit of treating every kind of social problem as if it was a crime problem and could most effectively be managed by defining certain people as bad guys, other people as victims, putting government in the position of sort of prosecutor and judge and punisher, sort of trying to govern. And I believe, and I argued in the book, that we've, you know, not only have we extended that to all kinds of sort of crime-related problems like drugs, but into areas where it has no business at all, like schools, and trying to address failing schools as if, you know, it was a crime to not hit a test score target of some sort. This is a chance to go in the opposite direction, right? We've had a situation, cannabis production and distribution and consumption, that for the years and much longer period really than that has been subjected to wave after wave of criminalization, of turning what would be lawful transactions and activities of people into criminal actions, you know, rewarding criminal networks for getting involved in and giving criminal profit premiums to those organizations to do it. We have a chance to take that back and show that we can actually govern a fairly complicated system, right? I mean, the nice thing about cannabis as an example, as a potential learning moment, teachable moment, experiment, if you will, for America, is that it's not a huge problem. It's not an unlimited problem. We can distinguish it from a lot of other currently legal substances, etc. But it's also not a simple problem. And as benevolent as many of us believe it is, it has obvious issues associated with it. As the parent of teenagers right now, I'm more concerned than I was as a heavy pot-smoking teenager myself 40 years ago about the potential impact of cannabis use on exposure to schizophrenia during that narrow window of time when young people are sometimes vulnerable to that disease. There's a lot of issues there, but we now have a chance to show that we can manage those issues much better by actually legalizing all parts of the supply chain. And if I have a criticism of our current system, there's some things I really like about the medical model in a way, because it does, it makes people very reflective, I think, about the drug nature of what, you know, cannabis involves, and the biological and psychological responsibility that ought to go along with any kind of regular use of it. But at the moment, it doesn't seem to me that we've achieved a fully legal system. I mean, putting aside the problem of dealing with the feds, who are obviously a real player here, it doesn't seem to me, and I'm not an expert on, as much as say my colleague Rob McCoon here, and you ought to have him on your show at some point, but we still have some ambiguity as to the legality of the supply. I think some of your folks up there who are producing it don't feel fully secure in their ability to be protected by the law, and we still have some criminals who are probably profiting from the ability to sell into the medical market. So I'd like to see us go that next step and try to fully incorporate the entire supply chain in a legal system. Not only will we derive revenues from that, and we ought to be a little bit more creative maybe about how we make visible that. I don't know, maybe we should fund, because we desperately need more police officers in California, especially police officers incentivized to do more progressive things than war on drug type activities. Maybe we could fund that with the taxes that would come from a robust legal cannabis business. But certainly the opportunities are enormous to really demonstrate to people not that marijuana is a utopian instrument and that it has no problems, but that we can handle even a fairly complicated substance like cannabis with a legal system, and will be more effective at keeping it out of the hands of kids and keeping criminals from making profits on it.
Okay, this is KZYX. Our program today is talking about California. I'm Cal Winslow, your host. This morning, we're talking to Professor Jonathan Simon. He's a professor of law at the Bolt School of Law at the University of California in Berkeley. He's the author of many books. We've been hearing about some of them. I thought now, John, unless there were some things we passed up, and we've passed up a lot, I might ask you about your most recent book, and then maybe that goes into your current work. But on my list, one of your most recent books is Mass Incarceration on Trial. Could you talk about that for a bit?
So it takes us back to this Brown versus Platt, a decision in 2011, the Supreme Court decision. This is a decision that really had a huge impact on our state. Realignment, which is the policy, although it's kind of a stealth policy, by which non-violent, non-serious, non-sex felonies are currently instead of going to prison, as was happening up until about a year ago, people in the so-called nons are now going to a county court where they can go to jail, they can be put on probation, the counties might be able to certainly have the opportunity to create new innovations like restorative justice that might be an alternative to jail. So we're at a real change moment in California, and we can talk about what it means. Already something like 25,000 prisoners roughly have been reduced. That doesn't mean anyone's actually left prison early. It means that mostly the people who would have gone to prison are currently being sent to counties. Now, there's huge looming questions about what's going to happen to them, and I hope we have a few minutes to get back to it. But what's sort of the passion behind this book, Mass Incarceration on Trial, is what led the Supreme Court to do this. This was a huge intervention. Justice Scalia called it the most radical injunction in our nation's history, and nearly hit the panic button describing tens of thousands of criminals that would somehow be released by this order. What led such a conservative group of people as the Supreme Court of the United States to, and even our liberals on the Supreme Court are conservative when it comes to crime, what led them to put the brakes on mass incarceration? Well, it was a real humanitarian crisis that was created in California's prisons, a crisis that most Californians don't know about. And that's really why I wanted to write this book, because I think it's something all Americans need to appreciate. It's, in a lot of ways, what I like to call California's Abu Ghraib moment. Everybody remembers maybe even where they were when they first saw those awful pictures of human bodies being stacked up in an Iraqi prison by American personnel. And however you felt about the war in Iraq or about the war on terror, I think every American basically felt ashamed by those pictures and said, that's not what I had in mind. Even George Bush said that. I think we had that moment with California prisons, except that nobody saw the pictures except the Supreme Court. There were actually one of the most remarkable things about the Supreme Court opinion is that they actually appended three photographs to their opinion, something that they very rarely do. Two of these were pictures of overcrowded sections. And your listeners can simply go online, you know, Google Brown versus Plata and, you know, check, or your favorite search engine, I should say, and hit the search, the image function, and you'll see lots of these images of prisoners in stacked up triple bunks, filled up spaces that were once gymnasiums or learning spaces or even hallways in prisons. And what these are emblematic of is the fact that for more or less a decade, our prisons were operating at 200 to 300% of capacity. And in the worst of these prisons, that meant literally people spent their entire sentence surrounded by other people who were, after all, considered dangerous criminals. And we can talk about their gang system and all the ways that it's very insecure in our prisons. But they were literally cheek by jowl with very few correctional officers able to guard them in this really refugee camp-like setting. So when the court, that was one image that clearly impacted the court. The idea that prisons are secure places of incapacity, you know, incapacitating dangerous people and doing justice is simply not compatible with, you know, an image of squalor and just crowds of people who are supposedly dangerous but aren't being effectively secured or guarded. The other picture was maybe even more dramatic, Cal. It was something that I think every Californian should take a look at, if not print out and put next to their calendar. It's a picture of what California called a dry cell. It was essentially a telephone booth-sized cage in which California, in an effort to actually prevent psychotic prisoners from suiciding themselves because they had no place to put them in this, you know, terribly overcrowded system, they were actually taking deeply psychotic prisoners, putting them into these cages naked. They were dry because they had no, you know, plumbing, for the entire day, you know, essentially, so that they could keep an eye on them. They would have them in hallways of the prisons, essentially sitting in their own urine and feces for days and weeks and sometimes months. And these were the picture. I think it was a picture of this dry cell that may have broken the broken the logjam on a court that has been indifferent to the inhumanity of prisons for a long time now. And if you listen to the oral argument, Justice Breyer actually gets this picture out, asks the California lawyer to look at it, and he says to him, you've got a big human rights problem on your hands. And I think that's the truth of it. We actually engaged in something that could be described as industrial-scale torture of prisoners during the 90s and at least the first part of this last decade. People should be held accountable for it. I don't know that they should go to prison, but there ought to be some kind of truth and reconciliation commission that looks into the suffering that went on to fellow Californians. In Europe, if this kind of thing had happened, people would be in The Hague, I think, you know, answering human rights charges for designing prisons that were intended to hold people in inhumane conditions. And for a lot of Californians, we accepted the idea that tough prison sentences were a reasonable way to address what seemed like an out-of-control crime problem, but we did not authorize, you know, torture. And I think we need to have a public reckoning about that.
And just a minute ago, you asked me to ask you about, I think it was about going back to what is happening to the people, the 20,000 or so. Was that your question?
Well, what's very important now is to understand what this realignment moment really means for us. And, you know, to put it in a sort of Dickens Tale of Two Cities framework, right, this could be the best of times in the sense that realignment could mean that after 40 years of essentially taking prisoners, sort of pulling the crime problem to the state level, where we framed a very kind of alarmist politics of crime with long prison sentences and the politics we've been talking about, moving away from that and toward a locally based system where people who really have a long-term interest in their fellow citizens and recognize that, hey, they're coming back from prison and it makes sense to try to deal with them now, whether it's through drug treatment or mental health treatment or better interventions so that they can, you know, long term, we're going to have them here in our county. I think there's a real chance that we could actually produce a much better, more effective, more just system than we've had through realignment, because it'll give these local counties a chance to innovate. And indeed, the best counties, and I hope Humboldt is one of them, I haven't looked at it, but your listeners ought to inquire into this, should be seeking, because realignment means that money will be coming from the state coffers, going to the counties, and the counties can decide how to spend it. They can spend it building more jails or more jail space, or they can spend it creating new innovative programs, right? And so it's possible that, you know, as I said, that this could be the moment where we really begin to see a long-term change toward creative solutions that get us out of this, you know, mass incarceration pattern. But what I'm worried about is that, you know, with state, county, counties getting money that they can use to just build jails, and everybody knows how to build jails, and it's certainly a less risky thing to do in terms of nobody's going to later say, well, you didn't do a good job, than it is to try to create something new. But that is kind of where we are now, and it's very important, as I said, because county-level government is the part of our government that we kind of know the least about, and most of us don't know who our county supervisors are or what they're up to. But this is an issue where I very much urge your listeners to try to do some local research.
Okay, and it's Mendocino. One more question, and then we'll sum up, I think. One of your books is has a part of its title, a culture of fear, and I'm not sure this is what the book is about, but something that came up here in a couple of conferences was local Latinos talking about life in places like Fort Bragg, the problems that they felt confronted them in trying to move towards stability and possibly citizenship. And I think that the idea of a culture of fear is kind of fitting here, because we had two people talking about how on a daily basis you would be worried about going through a stop sign, or your kid getting in trouble at school, into a fist fight in the schoolyard, or not paying some bills on time, that that there was just this constant level of tension and fear in people's lives that went on for years. Do you think that's something that goes beyond the people we talk to?
Yeah, that's a wonderful example. And, you know, again, we could spend an entire hour talking about the way our immigration policies, which we now all agree are broken but don't necessarily agree on how, have been perverted by this kind of fear of crime era, where we've turned everything and you know, metaphors like people being illegals, quote unquote, make it easier to do that. But it's a tremendously perverse thing for two reasons. One, lots of sociological research that immigrants are almost always less inclined to get involved in crime than almost anybody else, primarily because they've taken huge risks to come over here to take advantage of work opportunities, and they face enormous risks in committing crimes out of their normal environment. But sociologists have found that repeatedly, right? So we're focusing on our fear on the wrong people, and then as a result, our immigration system has become a kind of it's a textbook example of a legal system that degrades people, right? That exposes them to extraordinary risks and treats, you know, people in a way that makes them not be able to fulfill their obligations as parents, et cetera. It's a really a dramatic situation. Now, the other thing I just want to say briefly about this is one of the reasons I talked about the culture of fear is because it's not just, you know, there's lots of things we can be afraid of, but what we really learned in the era of governing through crime and the war on crime was a fear that's based on what I call stranger danger. And it sort of, it probably has very deep, maybe even evolutionary roots in terms of our fear of predators, et cetera. But it does mean that we are very inclined, even hardwired, toward focusing our fears on definable individuals, right? Especially if they're other in some way. And of course, immigrants can fit that to a T, even though they're not, in a sense, objectively a threat. The other side of that, though, is that it's very hard to get people mobilized against real risks, like, say, global warming, that don't take that form. You know, our state right now is in danger of infrastructure weakness, of climate change that's going to put enormous stress on that infrastructure, and it's very hard to get people to get scared of that. It's very easy to get people to be scared of strangers, and therefore, even as we face need for real investment in a lot of other things, I think it's we're in real danger of being panicked into stranger danger fear. So I can't emphasize enough the need to question our fears and to question whether we're not scared enough of some things and too scared of other things.
Okay, and another one for you, looking at it's the CV here. This is something that has always been very interesting to me, and I may put it as kind of, who are the people that we're talking about in this discussion? And I see you use the phrases poor discipline, social control, the underclass. Could you, who are the people that we're talking about in this discussion?
Well, you know, that was my first book, and the underclass, of course, is a term of art being used more regularly in the 80s and when I wrote that book, coming out of William Jewis Wilson, the astounding sociologist. But I think it's still very much true, which is to say, when we look at the areas in which we're largely removing people to incarcerate them, they're coming from both urban places like in L.A. and Oakland, but also now rural places that are really affected by, among other things, the loss of economic opportunity. I mean, it used to be that, you know, the people who got involved in crime were sort of on the edges of what we used to call the working classes, and they were people who could sort of go work in factories, but maybe they got involved in crime instead, and after a while in prison they could go back to the factories. What I found when I did the research on California parolees back in the 80s for that book was that more and more of the people we were incarcerating belonged to a sector of our population that had largely been walled off from our economy by deindustrialization and essentially the displacement of jobs out of the inner city. That's still, I think, a very real scenario, even though our urban landscape is undergoing a lot of restructuring. But one of the things that hangs over our moment is, you know, the failure to really address the loss of industrial jobs. It's probably not something that you feel every day in the northern part of the state, but in places like Oakland and Richmond that became the cities they were because of the industrial age, the failure to really plan for a transition to a meaningful economy, it has had enormous consequences in creating this kind of underclass. And by the way, maybe we can learn from Humboldt. I was just struck the other day by realizing on an interesting show that before Richmond got industrialized in World War II, one of its biggest industries was greenhouse farming of roses and other flowers, something that Japanese-American farmers did, and they were displaced by the internment. Maybe we should be raising medical cannabis in new greenhouses in these deindustrialized cities, but we need to find some way to put people to work.
You'd find a lot of people agreeing with you on that in Mendocino here. The interesting thing, of course, is that you mentioned Oakland and other places, but in Fort Bragg, we had at one point one of the biggest lumber mills in the world. It's now closed, and of course, the timber industry remains in decline, and the fishing industry has followed right along. So we certainly have those conditions here in a place I suppose many people outside of Mendocino probably think as a vacation land. Jonathan, this has really been great. We have a couple of minutes left, and I'm just looking through my notes to see what we have left out. Let's go back, since it's so much in the news, to the issue of guns. You talked about the mental health aspects, and I thought that was really interesting. What about guns, though? Could you talk to us a bit about that? People up here have guns, you know.
Sure, and I don't think, you know, I think it's very important when we think about guns and the role that they've played in our crime problem and our social policies to recognize that there are different kind of cultural, and this is my, you know, my other hat is thinking about the cultural lives of law. I mean, the current gun, you know, the gun culture that we associate with contemporary American life is very focused on urban insecurity. I mean, if you look at the people who kind of have bought guns in recent decades, who kind of came into gun ownership during this period, and even the Supreme Court's discussion of guns in the Heller case a few years ago, the focus is very much on crime and security. The reason that guns became as popular for contemporary Americans as they became in recent decades is fear, really. It's part of this culture of fear. And so I think we have to address guns as part of a larger discussion about whether this culture of fear is detrimental as a larger force, rather than focusing just on guns. You know, I blogged recently on what I found terrifying in the Oscar Pistorius drama in South Africa, this image of somebody in a gated community with a handgun right next to his bed, so racked with fear of crime, and again, this is his story, maybe it's not true, but that he shot to death his own girlfriend, who posed obviously no risk to him at all. Now, again, that may be a self-serving story, but it's a story that comes out of a stronger cultural nightmare. Many people do have a gun in their night table. It's because we fear, you know, criminals coming into our house. And again, while we can talk about gun control laws, I think unless if we address that larger culture of fear, then I think guns will right-size themselves. And it's not a problem to have guns when you're hunting, or as Joe Biden said the other night, if you want a shotgun to deal with some post-apocalyptic scenario you have in mind happening to you after the next big storm or something. It's the fear of crime that I think has pushed the logic of handguns, of concealed carry, of the sort of overextension of the gun culture that we've seen over the last few years.
Okay, and a last word. What about the prisoners themselves? I think the Pelican Bay prisoners have been in the news. Do you see something coming from inside the prisons?
Yes, I think this is a very important moment. The prisoners, by putting their own bodies on the line, basically through hunger strikes over the last couple of summers, have begun to do something I thought was impossible, which is pull, you know, public attention to the conditions, you know, the fact that we have created something that never existed anywhere in the world up to now, which is a system of, you know, a large-scale, you know, solitary confinement of people for multiple-year sentences. That's something that no other legal system has ever done before. It's usually been considered inhumane. It produces usually severe mental illness in people. Again, it's one of those Abu Ghraib features of our system that we've never confronted, and it's really important that the prisoners have done this by focusing on their basic human rights. They're not claiming to be a revolutionary vanguard or any of the kind of stuff that 40 years ago sometimes people associated with prisoner movements. This is about whether we lose our humanity in treating people as if they are not human. I urge people to read what the prisoners are demanding. There are things like the ability to wear a cap, you know, during the cold months up in those northern areas like Pelican Bay, the ability to know why you're being held there. I mean, many people are held on suspicion of being members of prison gangs, but the only proof it required is essentially evidence that guards associate with gang involvement. You don't have to be proven to have done anything with a gang. And indeed, we ought to question whether people should even be punished for being part of gangs that have actually essentially filled a vacuum left by our unwillingness to actually create a humane regimen inside our prisons. So it's a very big issue. The fact that Tom Amiano's committee was holding hearings on it just, I believe, yesterday, it's a very important moment, and I hope that people will let their legislators, Assembly and Senate members, know that they actually care about the human beings that are being held up at Pelican Bay and also in several of our other state prisons that have SHUs. That's the Secured Housing Unit is one of California's grim acronyms for what's essentially a total isolation unit where people are kept 23 hours a day, no programming, no education, no work, no human contact. And as I said, in most of the rest of the world, there's no question that this would be viewed as a human rights situation.
Well, lots to think about. Jonathan, thank you very much. This is Talking About California on KZYX, our weekly program of discussions with Californians. We've been talking to Jonathan Simon, who's a professor of law at the Bolt School of Law at the University of California in Berkeley, about his work as a law instructor and about his writing, and I do hope, Jonathan, that we could have you back someday. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And again, we'll talk next week at the same time. This is Cal Winslow, and the program is talking about California. Good morning.